So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, fake news. Will it be our downfall? Our panel decides if Facebook really are to blame and what can be done about it. David Walliams is to launch a new late night show on ITV, but it means the return of the news at when? As Tom Bradby's show shifts around the schedule, will that gamble pay off? Plus, we unpick all the latest goings on at Auntie with the launch of the Netflix of radio, whatever that means, and the National Lottery following BBC Three Online. All that and your media quiz. It's all to come on today's Media Podcast. And joining me at the Hospital Club today are three, count them, three more wonderful, intrepid players of the media game. They are, to my right, Faraz Osman, Maggie Brown, and Louise Ridley. Louise, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now, your surname remains the same. Your email address is different.
Yes.
Because when you were last on the show, our Brexit special, you were at HuffPo.
I was.
You've now Brexited HuffPo yourself.
That's on my own leave. Yep.
And you now work for BuzzFeed.
I do, yes.
How's that going?
It's great, thank you. Yeah, I'm the news editor for long form and special projects, which took a while for me to be able to say smoothly. But it's a great job so far.
So Brilliant. That means the posh stuff, the journalism.
The heavy long form,
no lol
serious,
cat.
High quality. No lolling, quite serious, in fact. So okay. Very different from what some people may imagine from BuzzFeed, but it's brilliant.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. So everyone judge Louise's analysis throughout this show and rate BuzzFeed accordingly for their journalistic prowess. Faraz is back as well. Faraz, Fred Wave, Skin Shape, Law Holt. What do these three obtuse names have in common?
I don't know. They sound like new punk bands. Should I know what they are?
They are acts on the latest episode of Four to the Floor, the excellent show that your Indie Lemonade Monday produced. And you're not down with the kids as you'd like to think.
Well, I had an executive, James execs it, and James's taste in music is terrifyingly good.
Sounds like an excuse.
The guy's, it is an excuse. I'm like, I wish I could keep up to the level that they send out. But the series is done now. We've been doing a social series on Facebook, actually, called All Day Breakfast, which has been a heck of a lot of fun.
A social series?
Yeah, so we spoke to Channel 4 about how we can elevate that brand. We feel like, because it's obviously music and it's a thing that resonates really well online, you know, what can we do to kind of reach that audience? Because that's where natively they're consuming that sort of content, and it's a younger audience, and obviously that's natively where they are. So we did what I think is Channel 4's first Facebook native show. It's a lot of fun. Watch it.
Wow.
It's
okay. Funny. And was that on Facebook Live?
It wasn't on Facebook Live. It was going to be, but
I need someone to explain to me what the point of Facebook Live is.
Was
properly.
It on all four?
It wasn't on all four. It's on Facebook, so you can watch it on Facebook. Whether you call video on Facebook Facebook Live now, I don't know if there's a.
You do not.
Right. Okay. So it's Facebook video.
Right.
It wasn't live because there's lots of obviously editorial concerns with Channel 4 have by putting things live, handcuffed a little bit more than other outlets are.
Maggie, you are here, but you've also been on a certain other BBC-based media show this week.
Yes, I was on the Wednesday media show.
Don't like to have sloppy seconds normally, but you're a special lady. Tell us what you were discussing with
our friends this week. Well, actually, I was there because earlier in the day there'd been a Voice of the Listener and Viewer conference, and I was actually on the panel discussing Channel 4 and the fact that it was still being kept in a form of limbo because all options appear still to be open about its future ownership and kind of structure, really, or even location, because there's even a view it might possibly go to Birmingham. So I was on the panel because I'm writing the second volume of the history of Channel 4, as you may know, which runs
pre-order
from
now.
2007 to, 2016. So it's still in research and writing stage.
Okay, quick question for you on your history of Channel 4. Since you are the Channel 4 historian, do you think there was more of a change from launch of Channel 4 to 2007, or more of a change since 2007 to now?
I think actually the biggest change happened before 2007 because they added in advertising in 1993. And once you have an advertising sales force within your company, a lot changes, including the rates of pay and the dynamics, the bonuses, all the rest of it, because the commissioning side obviously has to keep up with the advertising side, with the bonuses and everything that goes along with it. So it was much more commercialised from that point on.
Interesting. So even including All Four and multi-channel and all of that?
Well,
Bake
it's
Off,
on the... More radical
changes happening in the past.
Bake Off is actually something else. The reason, obviously, Bake Off was bought is that Channel 4 doesn't have Big Brother anymore. It's looking for scale. It would have been extremely worried if Bake Off had gone to ITV. It doesn't really fit the Channel 4 mould of either being experimental, new, fresh or anything else. But what it does fit is the fact that it's a Robin Hood kind of culture, that they have to have programmes which will pay for the programmes that don't make money. At least that's the model. So that's how they'll justify doing it. I think it's a very bad piece of PR for them, actually, at this moment in time.
If Bake Off with the new guys fails, is it still a success? Is it still a win for Channel 4 because they've neutralised the threat of Bake Off?
I doubt it will fail. Remember, Channel 4, 95% is funded by advertising. It doesn't have any in-house production. It's not allowed to own rights anymore. It doesn't have an international sales arm. So it's very, very focus. Think of it, £9.50 out of every £10 basically has to come from advertising. So from that point of view, its real opponent, if you like, in the marketplace is ITV. So it has to fight very hard to actually... There's a very hard commercial core at the centre of Channel 4. And so the advertising is its lifeblood. I don't think it will fail, but what I do think is that there wasn't anything wrong with the bake-off that the BBC was delivering. Now, the production company fell out of love with the BBC because of the way they were being paid and treated, but it is unwise, I would have thought, to perhaps A, annoy almost 16 million people who liked it just the way it was, and secondly, at this point in time, it looks as if Channel 4 has spare amounts of cash that it can just call up to acquire a programme which is purely a commercial decision, when it finds it quite hard apparently to find, say, £2 million extra a year for more older children's programming and content. So that's kind of a bit of a problem, but the big one is survival for Channel 4.
There you are, Maggie Brown there with some blue chip Radio 4 endorsed media analysis of some real news. But we're going to move on to talk about the big story of the past fortnight, fake news now, because after President-elect Donald Trump still feels weird to say it, and his victory, many commentators have sought to blame publishers like Facebook for not screening their content more accurately. Is that their fault, or should readers be more sensitive to where their news comes from? Louise Buzzfeed have been doing some research in this area.
Yeah.
Campaigning, you might almost say.
Well, we've been very much kind of at the forefront of looking into this. You know, fake news was something I hadn't heard of probably a month ago, 2 months ago or something, and it's really, really come to the forefront because of the American election.
And actually, for people who haven't been following it diligently, just explain actually what we mean
by
fake news.
Fake news is exactly as it sounds, but you have to really get your head around it, because it's not news that's accidentally incorrect, which we must admit journalists do sometimes. It's not satirical news that's misunderstood. It is fake news that has been written often for a purpose to distort people's political views or to get people very excited, and they're completely false, huge claims. So BuzzFeed Canada did a great analysis, sort of really comparing how many shares on Facebook the top 20 fake news stories during the last 3 months of the election were, how many shares they got as compared to the top 20 real news stories, and the fake ones got more. They got 8 million shares in 3 months, whereas the real ones only got 7 million. So the top fake stories, I think, were something like the Pope endorsing Donald Trump. You know, that's a huge libelous, made-up claim. And then Hillary Clinton funding ISIS or something ridiculous. You know, these are not sort of joke stories or under the radar. These are huge to do with global affairs, and millions of people shared them. And you have to assume believed them, because not that many people would share it if you had noticed that it was completely rubbish. The thing that's really scary, in my view, is there are whole sites dedicated to doing this.
Sometimes, and what's in it for them? Advertising?
Well, sometimes advertising, but also with political intent, I would say. I can't claim to know all about all of these fake sites at all, but...
And some of them are set up in Russia and China and places
like
that.
Some of them are indeed. They're really varied. The thing that's sort of really concerning is that, obviously, Trump is now president-elect, as discussed. The vast majority of these top shared fake stories were pro-Donald Trump or anti-Hillary Clinton. So the concern that's come up, which is why this is now on the agenda, is did that shape the election? The amazing thing is that Mark Zuckerberg initially at least said, that's a crazy idea. Of course not. If you think about it for more than 10 minutes, and I think he's now acknowledged this because Facebook is looking into this officially, of course it would have shaped the election, because think how many people use Facebook and how your entire narrative is framed by it. I think this is much bigger than Facebook, though. I think it's about Facebook needing to keep an eye on this. It's about who on earth are these sites doing this fake news. That's the real problem. And you have to assume that the amount of fake news being created has gone up. It's to do with Facebook changing its algorithms, but it's also this is being done a lot more because people have realised they can do this. And equally, it's about the public, thankfully, now becoming more conscious of this. And the important thing for us as journalists in terms of investigating, in terms of transparency, is making people aware how important it is that what you read is correct. That's a new concept.
Readers have always had to distinguish what they think is correct, and there have always been newspapers and magazines that deliberately make up stories and fabricate lies. I mean, there's been the Weekly World News and the Sunday Sport and whatever. Mm. People, you know, people believed that. Then
never made up claims about senior politicians endorsing things. You know, you can't actually get away with that in a newspaper because the politician would sue you. I mean, it's ridiculous. So the internet is not governed in this way.
So, Maggie, should there be a legal framework to deal with this, do you think?
Well, I mean, interestingly, I was at lunch yesterday with the chief executive of ITN, and this was very much part of the kind of discussion. And one of the things that we all kind of agreed in a way was that, say, even 5 or 6 years ago, people really thought that news programs, edited news programs, were on the way out. And I know that there was a big debate, for example, at Channel 4, you know, what should be the kind of agenda of Channel 4 News, which has always been an hour and long form. It survived as it had been before. And of course, now everybody is feeling kind of maybe the moment has come, because if you have a very clear brand, if you're trusted, if you have to obey impartiality rules, which the public service broadcasters have to, news programmes, and Sky News does as well, this actually may in the end not just be of, if you like, a social good, it may also actually be a commercial good or a reputational good, because it makes the role of respected organisations not just important, it actually makes them much more valuable. So there is a view that people will start to turn to the more trusted sources.
So I guess what I'm saying is, yes, intelligent people will. What about the people who just see a website that's clearly cobbled together, has got a mad story on it, but believe it? Are those people for us just stupid? Well, or are they Facebook's responsibility to say, no, they shouldn't be looking at that?
There's a few things to unpack there. The first is that it's not about people seeing sites, it's about people seeing Facebook. They go on Facebook and they see those headlines, and those headlines sit next to BBC headlines, Guardian headlines, BuzzFeed headlines, and they just assume that if the BBC and the BuzzFeed are providing me news in their space, then why isn't the Denver Guardian an official news source? Because, you know, I think that when you're saying it's not about people being stupid, it's about media literacy. And actually I think it's unfair to suggest that, like, you know, the Guardian is a UK paper, it's only just started making huge ground in the US, and I would argue that 5-10 years ago it was probably unknown in the US, and now the same is kind of happening the other way around. We know that the Boston Globe, as media literate people, the Boston Globe is a great paper, it does really interesting stuff, has really good articles in it, but I shouldn't expect my friends or people that don't work in the media industry to know the difference between the Denver Guardian and the Boston Globe. And that's where the manipulation is coming in. This is the media story, and it is one of those things that, is it going to break out of this bubble of these podcasts and this review and the media analysis that's going along and make traction like Leveson did? You know, this is in the shadow of Leveson. We had a multi-million pound inquiry into effectively the same sort of thing in mainstream newspapers. And you were asking earlier, is it, do we need a law to legislate against this? It's just impossible. This is an international thing that is shared by individuals. And a friend of mine was asking about, well, why is this any different to when the Daily Express or the Daily Mail or the Sunday Sport, as you say, print something on their front page? The difference is there are laws that do protect that. You can argue whether they need to be stronger or weaker, or, you know, you need to have this press regulation authority or another one. But if you take all of those laws away and that regulation away, then of course the thing that is going to get shared the most is the opinion that's going to back up the conspiracy theory that you've already got in your head. It's far more seductive, it's far more interesting, and it's a lot easier for anybody to just write something and put it up on Facebook and go, well, this is news.
But for us, do you remember, right, at, I mean, maybe 10 years ago when people were really excited about the internet? I remember this debate very well because obviously I'm a mother and these things concern me, but there were people who were arguing really against almost no controls on the internet. And gradually we've seen a growing concern about grooming of underage, you know, all of those things that have happened, and people asking for protections and for buttons and for, you know, and whether they're policed or not. But there's definitely been a shift away from just let it happen, even if you can't really do that much about it. So I don't know where this is going to end, but I think it's a rather frightening development. But I'm sure that there's going to have to be, as you rightly say, a huge amount of media literacy, warning people in some way that this kind of thing is going to pollute both your democracy, actually, in the end of the day, and undermine, if you like, our concepts of almost, you know, what is right and what's wrong.
I don't think there's anything the government can do. There's not a huge amount that Facebook can do. The genie's kind of out the bottle.
Facebook can blacklist sites. Louise, where do you stand on that?
Well, that's the difficulty. I know something we might discuss that's also been in the news is around Facebook possibly developing software for wanting to get into China, which would allow Chinese government or any third-party people who work with it to sort of make stories less visible on Facebook. And that's sort of the opposite extreme of the fact that we've got this fake news because there's no control. But obviously, a lot of us in Britain would say, well, that doesn't sound very good that the government can decide to hide certain stories. And it's where that balance is. It's a very, very difficult area because of how huge and powerful Facebook is already. We didn't make these rules to start with. Now we're in this position of, yes, some control might be good. We might say perhaps hide fake stories. But who is it? Is it someone within Facebook who's deciding, I don't like that, or I've checked all those facts? Mm. And we won't know because Facebook is a massive company, but it's not a state company. So it's who is the judge of that? And that is horribly complicated. And that's going to be the next big thing. Who decides what shouldn't be shown to people?
And of course, these fake sites, they're made to look as if they are entirely respectable. I mean, this is the interesting thing about it. I mean, people who are not, you would think, necessarily completely, say, literate in English, for example, don't seem to put spelling mistakes in that you can spot things.
Since this story's become really big, BuzzFeed's kind of taken it on globally, so beyond the kind of Trump stuff, we had a brilliant feature about Myanmar. So in 2014, only 1% of people in Myanmar had the internet. So suddenly they've got the internet, they've got Donald Trump, and they've got fake news. Within 2 years, suddenly everyone's got the internet. It's an explosion. Mm. And they are going through all of this because there's a massive fake news onslaught. And it's dealing with exactly the same stuff because the same people are trying to target them with all these stories. And there was some brilliant quote that I've got noted down, which is that someone who just got on the internet, just bought her first ever phone, which has the internet, said, that's what the internet is. It takes people who say crazy things and it makes them famous. So they'd never heard of Donald Trump. And along came Donald Trump in the last 6 months. They heard of him and they just say there's crazy things everywhere. And reading that and seeing how it must be to come onto the internet now with all this is really, really enlightening.
Imagine never having heard of Donald Trump. What bliss. let's move on to talk about a story from ITN now. They are to close their archive, ITN Source, in a new deal that means almost 1 million clips from over 60 years are now only going to be available through Getty Images. Smart deal for ITN, Maggie, do you think?
Well, I think it's running an archive, I think, is very expensive. You have to have people to hunt down what you want. You can't just automate everything. And in fact, yes, I was discussing this again yesterday at ITN. And the thing is really that they've handed over the marketing and sales. It doesn't mean that they don't archive things anymore, because obviously they have a growing and added to every moment of the day almost archive. But what they're doing is saying that this body has more expertise, that they can act almost as our agent. And a lot of people have agency arrangements and outsource things. So I don't think it's actually too much of a worry. What ITN is trying to do is, in a sense, a bit like other broadcasters. It's trying to actually build up its content ownership business. It's trying to add in program making, which is playing to its strengths. So it might be current affairs, it might even eventually be scripted drama. So that's where they see the margins.
And they don't actually have to be people selling it. But the problem is there's only one game in town now, really, Getty. Yes. That's the problem, isn't it? Yes.
Well, for those sorts of images, I don't know is the answer. I don't know what the BBC does with its archive. But on the other hand, remember, Getty is being run by Dawn Airey, late of Channel 5, and I imagine that ITN must have had a good reason to think that they would be treated in a fair and reasonable way.
OK, let's bring out the saxophones, fire up the carpool karaoke, because we're going to talk about late-night telly now. ITV are bringing over the format of the stripped late-night five-day-a-week chat show to our shores. It's never worked before. Faraz, is it going to work this time?
Will it work now?
Because they don't work, do they? These US-style shows. And the closest we got in our lifetimes was V. Graham Norton, which was jolly entertaining and still ran out of steam after 3 years. Mm. The idea behind this is that they'll have a different celebrity host running it for a week each. So David Walliams is week one.
Do you have enough celebrities? I think that we look over the pond and see those shows and almost... there's a little bit of kind of confusion or envy about whether or not, you know, why is it that those shows have so much social traction? I think that's the key thing to this, is that they do so well online now, when, you know, you're able to kind of clip out, be it, I'm going to get all my Jimmys mixed up now, but be it Jimmy Kimmel's Halloween specials or Jimmy Fallon's, you know, viral pieces with Questlove and the guys from The Roots. And I think that they clearly capable of having a noise beyond the scheduled programming, which I think is a key essential part of any commission nowadays. And if they're able to kind of crack that, so it's not just about what David Walliams is going to do at 10 p.m, but it's also what's going to happen post that, and are people going to talk about it in the same way that when John Oliver has a rant, everyone shares it on Facebook afterwards, and then they come back to that content from there. That's what this show needs to do. It is the right time for that. If we're always going to kind of look back and kind of go, well, this is just us trying to do the same thing that Letterman and Leno did, what, 20 years ago, then, yeah, I'm not sure that is going to work, but I don't think that's what this show is.
Well, actually, Jay Leno is a bit of a spectre here, isn't he? Because NBC ran his show when he left The Tonight Show first time round at 10 p.m, and it was a massive flop. Mm. Why are they putting it at 10 p.m, Maggie? Kevin Ligo's moving the news at 10 for this. Surely a late-night chat show should be late-night like it is in the States, 11:30.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it depends. 10 o'clock is quite late for quite a lot of people who, you know, if it finishes at 10:30, they then have to go to bed and get up in the morning and go to work.
But Faraz has just said it's all about them watching it on YouTube anyway. Who cares? Going to get low ratings.
Well, no, ITV wants people watching mainstream television and watching its commercials.
But there's nowhere in the world that they watch a high-gloss chat show at 10.
I mean, this is the experiment, isn't it?
It's going to fail.
Well, actually, oddly, I would be interested to see whether David Walliams, for example, has got the personal warmth somehow to carry this kind of show. I mean, he's great at what he does, which is sort of scripted. We'll just see whether he tries to be a great many things, including a children's author. I would have thought he doesn't actually have that kind of rapport with people, but I may be totally wrong. The really interesting thing is actually that, of course, the news is going to be moved to 10:30, and it isn't going to be clearly a show that's going to run around the year. And they do sometimes move the news if, for example, there's a big football match or something like that. But to move it for that length of time does raise a few alarm bells. And, of course, if it were to work, and you clearly have decided it's not going to work, but if it were to work, then it would definitely be a challenge to the news moving from 10 o'clock. Mm. And we're back in that old experiment which happened 16 years ago and was then reversed, and 10 years ago or 8 years ago, whenever it was. And, you know, you're back into that kind of thing. I don't know. It's all about IT. Basically, ITV needs to raise its audience share. It's got to do that. That's why it's got another edition of Coronation Street coming in, 6 editions a week. It's got to start building.
I mean, I'd like it to work. It's just this kind of show is aimed at people like me, roughly in my demographic, you know, in my interest. And I definitely wouldn't want to watch a show 5 nights a week on ITV. It feels a bit cheap for them.
As was 10 o'clock 10 o'clock live, and that didn't quite work either.
And that was once a week.
But and yeah, exactly. But I do think that this is, I don't think this is a case of, is an entertainment show going to work? That's almost like, for me, the secondary question. The primary question, and this is something that's always gone on throughout the history of, I think, you know, modern television, is can you provide an alternative to the 10 o'clock news? And I think ITV tried that in the past and failed. And well, ITV had the 10 o'clock news originally, but ever since the BBC have done the news at 10, or whatever they call it, the 10 o'clock news, the only thing that can compete with the 10 o'clock news on the BBC is the news at 10 on ITV. And that feels like it's not plurality. It doesn't feel like it's choice. It doesn't feel like what ITV should be doing. So I kind of applaud them for going, you know what, let's give an alternative. Because the reality is that I mean, I don't know, I haven't done the stats, but I would argue 5 times out of 10, the headlines are exactly the same on the BBC that they are on ITV. So let's provide something different from there. And if they get it right, then it means that people will watch more news as a result.
That's not strictly true, because as far as the ITV news programme has changed into a more discursive programme with Tom Bradbury, you know, with him having a more informal kind of one-to-one, say, with a correspondent. So it isn't exactly the same anymore. That's why they... And they say, actually, that... And it is, I think, the case that the ratings have gone up by about 6% so far this year over the 10 months of the new format. But having said all of that, all news programmes are up a bit because look at the news, you know. So I don't know. What I think is obvious, though, is that 10 o'clock is a good slot for, say, Channel 4 running Catastrophe or Fresh Meat or those sorts of programmes. It's wide open to or Fargo, one of these sort of more edgy sort of pieces. That's been very good for Channel 4. ITV can't really go there because it's still a big mass audience, so they have to find another way. It's an experiment, really. And of course, Kevin Ligo, he'd have been there a year. This is one of his moves as the new director of television. He took over from the more conventional, maybe, Peter Fincham. So we'll see.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Right, it's been almost 60 whole minutes of media podcast time since we covered the BBC, so let's get stuck into all the news that's come out of the corporation this week. First up, Charlotte Moore, the BBC's first director of content, has begun the latest shake-ups to BBC TV commissioning. Maggie, what's changing?
Well, I mean, she seems to be sort of flattening the structure, saying that there's going to be people sort of cooperating, really, it seems to me, across genres, which is quite interesting. One of the other moves, which... again, I think probably it's quite sensible. 2.5 years ago, the BBC started this big arts push with music core to it, with Radio 2 and so-called television, you know, doing things together. And that's being brought together and then television and radio put under the great empire that's growing of James Purnell, who's the kind of maybe director general in waiting. What interested me about that, they've given that brief, which I don't think has been running that smoothly, to one of the most brilliant commissioners in television, Jan Younghusband, who used to be at Channel 4 and did all the wonderful kind of wacky operas and big art projects, and was one of the really interesting commissioners and greatly revered throughout the arts and music sector, ballet, you name it. She goes across everything, and she's been given that brief. And so when I saw it, as always, you know, moving the deck chairs around, and there's all the cuts going on. But when I saw that, I thought, this is really interesting. The BBC is giving a real push to music and arts, which I think is good.
And on that James Pannell point, Faraz, he's now the BBC's head of religious affairs programming, as well as everything else. Presumably he coordinates the cleaning staff too. They said this is boosting the significance of religious affairs by giving it to such a top dog. It's not, is it? It's just adding it to his smorgasbord and minimising it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important that the BBC do religion and ethics properly. It's part of a reason that they're a public service broadcaster, and they need to make sure that they get it right, because if they don't get it right, no one else is. And, you know, we were just chatting about how Akhil Ahmed was taking on that role, and actually his biggest commission was Songs of Praise, which is a music show, so, you know, there may be some connection there along the way. But I think that what's interesting about this is, and Matt may hold me, who's producing this, Matt may hold me to the fire later on in the year, but one of the predictions I made for last year is that the BBC is going to move away from channels and move towards actually being brands like arts, music, sport, children's, etc. And this seems to be a movement towards that strategy. It kind of makes sense, but there's always, for me, the bigger question mark is not the case that he's going to be looking after religion, ethics and music and arts, but he's also going to be looking after radio and television and different types of content under that banner. I still think that's an open debate about, do you commission around the content that you make from a genre perspective or from a content perspective, be it radio, TV or online?
Meanwhile, the current Director General, Tony Hall, has been talking at the Voice of the Listener and Viewer conference. Faraz, he announced the Netflix of radio. That must have surprised Netflix. Can you explain what he means?
Well, my understanding of it is that he wants to open up the huge library. I mean, we talked about archive earlier. I mean, the radio archive that the BBC must have must be fascinating. And it seems to be a smart little move to open up that whole library. I'm interested to know how successful BBC Store has been. And it feels like the BBC keeps making baby steps into that space of getting their content online and making it successful as what the iPlayer has been, which is successful because of the content that's happened the week before. I think it is really important that the BBC makes success of its heritage content along the way, and this seems like a really smart move. And on top of that, I don't think that there is an audio version of this that exists. So actually having the ability to have that back catalogue and library, I think is something that audiences and consumers are going to love.
But actually, iPlayer Radio does have quite a lot of back catalogue available. It seems like they've already made this content available. The only thing they're changing by calling it the Netflix of radio is introducing the idea they might start charging people for it.
Possibly, but also, I mean, I like I said, I don't know how far this goes, but it's things that, all the way from nostalgia pieces of like, well, we just had this election which has been horrific and terrifying and everything that you possibly hate about politics all in one go, but it kind of opens up the appetite of, well, what were the Bill Clinton debates that happened at the time, and I want to hear those again. I want to hear what the presidential debates
such
were.
Such a nerd. How many people are going to listen to Bill Clinton's presidential debates?
My point is that it's taking on the opportunity to look at analysis as it was back then, which we love doing as consumers. And even
full media podcast catalogue available now. Download our episodes from 2 years ago.
Also, it's going to be internationally, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, which is a huge
thing. I mean, that's a huge boost, I think. And I must say, you know, if we're talking about the fake news side, I mean, remember too, this has been only now recently that the kind of expansion of the World Service into
Truth News
and indeed an enhancement to the English language service. So I mean, the BBC has been sent on a kind of weird mission. It was having to cut back and pay for everything 5 years ago. Now everybody realises the value of proper information, so it's all kind of been reversed and given a lot more money. I mean, it sometimes makes you weep and think that the government just sort of really just mucks around with the BBC unnecessarily. Just think of all those very competent people who were shown the door. Now, presumably, they're going to have to rehire lots of other language experts.
And under a much more complex finance structure, where they might be being funded by the government and they might be being funded by the licence fee.
Exactly. The whole thing is a bit of a mess, to be honest with you. But on the other hand, it's a better mess than not having those services, so I'm in favour of them.
Does it make sense to you, Louise, why the government would want to reinvest in the World Service, start up 11 new services?
Well, I mean, it sounds ambitious. I think, as you say, it's the way they do it that's important. But something I picked out from that, I think it's almost £300 million of extra funding that the government's putting adding in that they noted in what they're doing is the idea of focusing on slow news, which I thought was a great concept that I hadn't really heard articulated like that, which is the idea of explaining the why and kind of essentially analysis and deep stuff. And that is, if they do that, you know, live up to that promise, that is what we need in a time of fake news. That's really important. It's about slowing down. Yeah, and you know, the kind of thing I do with BuzzFeed is long form. It's the let's go deep into this, and then you're not definitely not doing any fake news. You're actually giving people that more thoughtful read, and people are craving that a bit now, I think.
And the World Service average age of listener is much younger than that of Radio 4 or 5 Live, as I understand it, which is quite interesting.
I think so. I don't know details, but I think so, especially because of the many languages.
And
so
there's people same with oddly that some of the television service, which it was aiming, it's sort of maybe, you know, young professionals and things like that who want to actually, you know, learn about what's going on. So I mean, all I know is that it seems to me like a quick reversal of things, and I bet you BBC monitoring, which they've been cutting back, that's more of obviously official government services using it, the Cabinet Office, you name it, I bet you if in a few months time we'll suddenly find they realize, oh my god, we've cut back on monitoring and we're not finding out enough about wherever it is, and they'll start reinvesting again, having bossed the BBC out of its lovely country house in Caversham. So that's how it goes.
Well, talking about cash flow, the BBC is not going to be releasing those big money balls on a Saturday night anymore on BBC One. The National Lottery is going online only. Yes, it's crashing news. For us, the big question everyone is asking is, what is going to happen to Nick Knowles and Gabby Roslin?
I didn't know. This is news to me. I thought that the BBC had won that contract.
They have. They've won the contract to put it online only.
Well, that's a turn up for the books.
It's the future for us.
Is the future? It's the future of watching balls drop in a online.
Is it right that no one wants to stay on a Saturday night and watch balls drop anymore, Maggie?
Well, I never take part in the lottery because I hate sort of gambling.
It's not so much of a TV spectacle, is it?
I don't watch the programmes, and so I'm. But you can see why it has to be the BBC will always get those contracts because the lottery can do deals with ITV. Or it can advertise it. So the only place it really can't get on in any other way is on the BBC. It cuts the cost of making those shows as well, remember. If it's just online, it's going to be sort of, you know, they have to all be complied very carefully. You've got to get that right. But apart from that, you know, for example, if you're out at night, you can find out, can't you, what the numbers are?
Can't lie, I've watched the lottery very much on TV, but it always seems rather like a space filler when if you have a lottery ticket, you just want to know the numbers. You could get that on the phone. Why do you need to watch them pulling out the numbers?
Why would you not want to see Jamelia sing her way through her new single?
It just seems a bit old school, I think.
It is
really
old school, but do remember that when this first happened, when we first had the lottery come on our screens, everyone watched it, whether they bought a ticket or not.
Yeah, because it's exciting.
For some reason, seeing these numbers appear was exciting because that idea that you were literally watching someone being made a multimillionaire, even if you were there or not, was actually quite a decent format at the time. And you know, you remember that there was the statistics of this ball's only been seen like once in the last few months. All of that was actually watchable and was felt like it had real value to it.
Cracking
and now,
theme tune as well.
Exactly. Maybe it is simpler times, but now it is. You're absolutely right. You know, if you want to know what the lottery numbers are, you just want to know what the numbers are based on a ticket that you've bought. So people check it online anyway, and they've continued to make entertainment formats around the lottery.
Popular.
And actually, game shows have been the saving grace of American telly in the last year, haven't they, for all the big networks there? Do you think we'll see fewer game shows now the lottery component's being taken away? Or on a Saturday night, will still people want to be watching Nick Knowles?
Well, I mean, people are the main television channels are absolutely desperate to find fresh entertainment formats. That is Saturday night in particular is really at the front of everything. That's what they want to do, and then they want to find factual formats that they can go on churning out for a day, you know. So there's all of that. I don't know, because also the kind of participation, you can use them all sorts of ways. Big entertainment formats are what everybody's after.
But the lottery is the ultimate interactive format, right? Everyone buys a ticket for £1 and everyone is a contestant.
£2 these days. It's been a while since you played.
Not everyone.
Well, no, but you can, anybody can be a contestant in that show. But because it's on the BBC, there's this weird kind of separation of that's the lottery, now that pit's been done, now let's do a game show. And if there was actually an opportunity to embed those two things together where you're watching someone randomly pick a number as part of the game show that they're watching, and then that has an impact of you as being a ticket holder back home, that's a format that I think would actually work and would be properly interactive and exciting. But it can't happen on
Last
the BBC.
Last Chance Lottery with Patrick Kielty, have you forgotten?
Yeah.
Singing, dancing, toe-tapping Saturday Night Entertainment.
Patrick Kielty.
Talking of quizzes,
Yay.
It's time for our media quiz. This week it's entitled All Change Please. Whilst the voice of Ollie Mann has been utilised across many high-end adverts and nature documentaries, do just contact my agent, it has yet to be the voice of any major rail network. I did do a corporate video this year, actually. It was for a company that sold you seats on the channel. Anyway, this is...
Seats on
board. Yeah, I don't know. Doesn't matter if it's for money. In a moment, I will perform three National Rail announcements, but here's the twist. Hidden within my apology for a late running service will be a very subtle reference to a media story from the past week. Very subtle. Your task is to decipher the message and tell me the media story buried within. Buzz in with your name, the winner gets the grand tour, the loser is still open all hours. Here we go.
Attention, passengers waiting for a Western service on platform 16. This train will now be stopping at Wogan.
Faraz. It's the renaming of BBC's Western House to BBC's Wogan House.
Correct. Point
to Faraz.
It's
really complicated when you're trying to go to a meeting there.
Is
as
it?
I did the other day, and I'm like, where is this building? It doesn't exist yet.
But a fitting tribute to the great man, Maggie, surely.
Well, why not? Is it? This is the one that's quite close to New Broadcasting House,
yes,
around the corner, where Radio 2
is.
Yes.
Home of Radio 2.
Yes, home of Radio 2.
I think it's
2,
lovely,
yes,
actually.
I don't mind that. It's quite nice. Yes.
Yeah, I agree. Here's announcement number two.
Passengers in first class, please note that this service will combine with another before making its way into our final cosmopolitan destination.
Louise. Is this Glamour magazine dropping its small format?
It is.
After 15 years?
Correct.
They've had a lovely handbag size format, which I think I remember coming along and being quite excited when I was a lot younger, because it was this very tiny magazine, and it was very exciting. You could put it in your handbag if it was such a size. Yes, it wasn't that small.
It wasn't that small, and I think it was a bit of a con, actually.
But it was smaller than the other magazines, which in some way was exciting.
But it is a nifty trick, so why have they stopped?
Well, they've stopped it. I don't know if it's anything to do with handbags changing, but they say it's because they want it. Well, you know, perhaps handbags have bigger or smaller. They say it's because they want to make it more high end. They want to make it, they're sort of upping the picture, the paper quality. They want to make it appear more luxurious, glossy, which is a pretty understandable move in the magazine market, because it's trying to be more like competitors like Elle, which are a bit more sort of weighty and glossy and bigger. So it's moving in that direction, as opposed to Cosmopolitan, which you referenced in your wonderful train announcement, which I think has sort of stayed where it is. It hasn't changed its price. It's actually slashed its price quite a lot.
You know, remember, magazines are really advertising media.
And the better you make the adverts,
the better
adverts
make,
look, the more
you know,
you're
I mean, so. I heard a figure for a page in Vogue that just blew my mind away. It's almost equivalent to kind of like the 3-minute ad that John Lewis, say, can buy.
Oh, it's like an annual salary, isn't it?
It's
to get
a huge,
Vogue,
huge amount of money. So I think that's part. And also, you know, something people do like, a sort of feeling of a treat when they pick up a magazine. Hence, you know, you've talked about going back to long form. Well, that's actually what Cosmo are doing. They're running bigger articles, you know.
And for a bonus point, can any of you name what Cosmo called Glamour's handbag edition?
Something rude, because they didn't like it, but I don't
Petite.
Know what.
You're close. Pygmy.
Pygmy.
All right. Goodness.
Here's announcement number three.
Would all customers please note that from Monday there will be a rise in ticket prices, which will, against all market theory, still lead to a rise in sales.
Buzzing with your name if you know the answer.
Maggie Brown. Well, it's the Eye, isn't it?
It is.
Yes.
The Eye newspaper have increased sales despite a 10 pence price hike. So Cosmopolitan slash the prices and do well. The Eye costs more and does well.
Well, Sunday Times has gone up, circulation has gone up, so has The Observer a bit, 2%. I think it's partly the fact people want to read about the world around them, news. So a slight revival. I don't know whether it will work or not, but interesting. It's still cheap, though, remember. It's much
it is
cheaper
still
than,
cheap. Compared to other broadsheets as well, it depends what you're comparing it to, doesn't it?
Exactly, £2 for The Guardian. You know.
I think The Eye hits quite a really good market. It's kind of hit that. It's sort of easy to read. It's got really good layout that's very, very clear, very simple, kind of almost like for an app generation, that kind of thing. But it is still cheap, so it hits a good spot.
I mean, I think I remember a time when The Guardian was actually experimenting at stations with a tabloid version of itself, just handing them out, and they were meant to be tasters. And I remember thinking, why don't they do this with the main paper? You know, do a cut down version and do a G, really. And it never happened. So well, it's nice to know some good news. As a former founder of the Independent, rather, it's good to know there's a bit of good news somewhere.
Nice to hear a bit of behind the curtain stuff at The Guardian just in the last minute of the show as well, isn't it? But it does mean, Maggie, despite you coming in with the right answer there, that we have a draw. So no clear winner.
That's fine.
apart from the Johnson Press this week. That is it for our show today. My thanks to Maggie Brown, Louise Ridley and Faraz Osman. Thanks too to these wonderful people who continue to support the show through their brand new voluntary subscriptions. They are Rex Orr, Chris Ashton and Saul Fernley. Join them, keep us on the air, go to themediapodcast.com/donate. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and the Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.